Welcome to our deep dive into testamentary and martyrdom literature.
Oh yeah, this is going to be a good one.
We're going to unlock some secrets and explore moral dilemmas and even catch glimpses of heaven.
Wow.
All through some pretty captivating ancient texts.
Yeah.
Get ready for a journey back to a turbulent period in Jewish history.
Buckle up.
Have you ever heard of testamentary literature?
I have.
It's this really fascinating genre modeled after
those
super dramatic deathbed blessings that Jacob gave his sons in Genesis 49.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I do.
Like, he's on his deathbed.
Yeah.
And he's like...
Giving out these prophecies
to each of his sons.
Yeah, it's like he knows he's at the end.
Exactly.
And he's trying to impart this wisdom, you know...
Totally.
...to future generations.
It's like those ancient authors were captivated by that same sense of gravity.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, they wanted to pass on wisdom and prophecy to the generations that came after them.
It's like a literary time capsule.
Just like Jacob did.
Yeah. And I think the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs
is
a really great example of that.
Okay, so break that down for me.
So imagine each of Jacob's 12 sons
getting
their own testament.
Oh, wow.
Offering ethical guidance and sometimes even peering into the future.
That's like a prequel to Genesis.
Kinda.
But with added prophecy?
Right, exactly.
That had to have been super popular back then.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're still talking about it today, right?
That's true.
And we have fragments of it.
Wow.
In Greek, Armenian, Slavonic, Hebrew, and Aramaic.
So many.
I know, right?
So this tells us it really resonated across a wide swath of the ancient world.
Yeah, a real hit.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But I did hear there's some debate about the dating of these texts.
Right.
And maybe even some Christian editions.
Uh-huh.
Is that true?
Yeah. So pinning down the exact date is tricky.
Tricky.
It's a bit of a scholarly puzzle.
A puzzle. Most scholars, though, think it originated sometime in the 2nd century B.C.
Okay.
But certain passages, like the one in the Testament of Simeon, where it talks about God taking a body and eating with men.
That's interesting.
Yeah. That might have been added later.
Oh.
Possibly by Christian scribes.
Interesting. Yeah. So that makes it harder to understand.
Yeah, it adds a layer of complexity for sure.
So how do we even begin to make sense of these potential additions?
Right.
Does it affect how we understand the original text?
Well, it definitely makes things more complicated.
Yeah.
It's important to think about historical context and consider the possibility of multiple authors and editors.
Multiple.
Yeah, think of it like a historical puzzle.
Okay.
Where we're looking for clues to understand how these texts evolved over time.
I like that the puzzle analogy.
It kind of fits, doesn't it?
Yeah. So we've got these potential Christian editions and we're trying to figure out the original text.
It's a challenge.
This all sounds super intricate.
It is.
Is there a way to connect these texts to the wider world at that time?
Absolutely. When we look at the Hellenistic world, which was a time of this intense cultural exchange between Greek and other cultures, including Jewish culture, we see an emphasis on ethics, piety, and asceticism.
Okay.
And these ideas are reflected in the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs.
So it's like a snapshot
kind of
the cultural anxieties and aspirations of that time.
Yeah, exactly. It's really fascinating to see that reflected in these texts.
So the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs doesn't just like rehash the stories from Genesis.
Right.
It also adds its own unique spin on them.
Right? Yeah, for sure.
And we're going to zero in on one testament in particular.
Okay.
The Testament of Levi.
Levi, all right.
What makes this one stand out?
Well, Levi's testament is unique.
Okay.
Because it doesn't happen on his deathbed.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Instead, it's all about his appointment as a priest.
Okay.
Which immediately presents a problem.
Okay. I'm listening.
How can Levi, who committed that brutal slaughter of the Shechemites in Genesis, be considered worthy of such a sacred role?
That's a big ethical dilemma.
It is, isn't it?
How does the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs try to reconcile this?
So they offer a really interesting justification.
Okay.
They suggest that Levi's actions were preordained.
Preordained.
As in...
Like it was destiny.
Oh, wow.
Like it was written on heavenly tablets.
Heavenly tablets.
Yeah, and it goes back and adds details about the Shechemites' past.
Yeah.
Like how they wronged Sarah,
okay,
Rebecca, and even Abraham.
Wow, so they frame Levi's actions as like a form of divinely ordained judgment.
Right, right, exactly. Like he was chosen to carry out this act of justice.
So it's like the author's reinterpreting history.
In a way.
To align with their view of Levi as this righteous figure. Yeah, they're trying to make sense of this difficult narrative.
And what does that tell us about the people of that time?
Right. What does it say about their anxiety?
Exactly.
It definitely suggests this need to reconcile deeply held beliefs with these challenging narratives.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting is that Levi's investiture as a priest takes place in this incredible heavenly realm.
Heavenly realms.
Yes.
This is where it gets really interesting.
I know, right?
What are these heavenly realms like?
Okay. So picture this.
Oh, okay.
Levi ascends through multiple heavens.
Multiple.
Yeah. The first one he encounters.
Okay.
It's kind of gloomy.
Gloomy, man.
Yeah. Filled with fire, snow, and ice.
Fire, snow, and ice?
Yeah. A place of judgment.
Wow.
Then above that is a second level.
Oh.
Teeming with armies.
Armies.
Uh-huh. All poised for judgment.
Against deceit.
Against deceitful spirits.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And above them, you find the holy ones.
Okay.
And highest of all is the awe-inspiring glory of God.
That's an incredible image.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's this complex and vivid cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
Very different from the more linear progression we see
in
other ancient texts, like 2 Enoch.
So it's like a totally different way of imagining the heavens.
Yeah. It shows the diversity of thought in the ancient world.
Levi journeys through all of these levels.
He does.
What happens during his ascent?
Well, he's guided by angels, of course.
Naturally.
And as he goes up,
he's
given priestly garments
that
are reminiscent of the high priest's attire described in Exodus 28.
Wait a minute. Are those the super detailed robes?
Yes.
Full of symbolic meaning?
Exactly. The text is drawing a clear connection between Levi's investiture and the earthly priesthood, imbuing it with this divine significance.
Wow. So the text is really emphasizing that connection.
Yeah. And there's even a connection to Isaiah 59,
where
God puts on righteousness and truth for judgment.
Oh, that's right.
Linking priestly attire to divine judgment itself.
That's a powerful connection.
It is, right.
So Levi's a priest now, divinely ordained and dressed for the occasion.
He's ready to go.
But there's got to be more to his story.
Oh, there is.
Isn't there a prophecy about his descendants?
You're right. There's this rather enigmatic prophecy.
Okay.
About Levi's seed being divided into three offices.
Three offices. Okay.
Yeah. One is described as greater than any other.
Okay.
The second is the priesthood.
All right.
And the third one is a bit mysterious.
Ooh, I love a good mystery.
Me too.
What can you tell us about this third figure?
Well, the text describes this figure as having a new name.
A new name.
Yeah. And being associated with a king arising in Judah.
Okay.
Who establishes a new priesthood.
Hmm. So this passage has sparked a lot of debate.
For sure.
With some scholars even seeing it as like a hint at a messianic figure.
It's definitely one of the more intriguing parts of the Testament of Levi.
So we've got secret knowledge, heavenly realms, and maybe even hints of a coming Messiah.
Could be.
The Testament of Levi is like a treasure trove of ancient intrigue.
It is a good way.
But before we get too deep into those mysteries, we need to shift gears a bit and talk about another genre of writing from this period.
Okay.
Martyrdom literature.
Interesting.
It seems like a natural progression, considering the turbulent times in which these texts were written.
For sure.
So what makes these stories so unique?
Okay, well, martyrdom literature emerges as a powerful response to persecution.
Persecution, okay.
Yeah, they offer stories of resilience and faith in the face of suffering.
So they give us a window into the challenges faced by those who dared to speak truth to power.
Absolutely.
Okay, so what should we be looking for as we explore them?
These texts often follow a certain pattern.
A pattern?
Yeah. You've got a true prophet who foresees his death.
Okay.
Then you have wicked false prophets who oppose him. A satanic figure orchestrates the conflict.
Okay.
A ruler condemns the prophet. And ultimately the prophet dies faithfully amidst persecution.
Wow. That's a pretty intense framework.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really captures the experiences mm-hmm. of those facing oppression.
It's a reminder that faith often comes at a cost.
Yeah, a powerful one.
And one of the most vivid examples of this uh-huh. is the martyrdom of Isaiah, right?
Indeed, the martyrdom of Isaiah centers on his death
okay.
at the hands of King Manasseh,
right?
A ruler known for his wickedness.
Wickedness, okay.
The text might reflect the yeah. historical transition from Hezekiah, a good king, to his son Manasseh, yeah. who turned away from righteousness.
Well, Isaiah's caught in the middle of a yeah. power struggle.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a story that feels sadly relevant even today.
It really does.
Right. We still see these kinds of conflicts playing out mm-hmm. throughout history.
And the text adds another layer of drama.
Oh, yeah.
By bringing in Beliar.
Belier, also known as Belial.
Right.
This yeah. powerful demonic entity.
Who does what?
He instigates Manasseh
okay.
to target Isaiah.
So it's like this yeah. classic battle between good and evil.
Right. Playing out on the stage of history.
It sounds intense.
It is.
Can you walk us through it?
Sure. So it's a tale of intrigue and betrayal.
Okay.
Isaiah initially flees to Bethlehem.
Bethlehem.
Where he joins other prophets.
Prophets.
Like Micaiah and Elijah.
The detail might be a bit.
It is.
Yeah.
It is bringing together characters from different time periods.
But it also shows the author's
yeah.
creative liberty
mm-hmm.
in creating this compelling narrative.
Right. They're taking some liberties to make the story more engaging.
So Isaiah is eventually betrayed.
He is.
Seeks refuge in the mountains
mm-hmm.
and is ultimately captured.
Unfortunately, yes.
Poor Isaiah. He was surrounded by enemies.
It seemed like it.
What happened after he was captured?
Well, his death is described in a particularly gruesome manner.
Gruesome.
The text repeatedly says that he was sawn in two.
Oh, wow.
With a wood saw.
That's a horrifying image.
It is a very brutal way to go.
It reminds me of the book of Hebrews,
uh-huh.
which mentions those who were sawn asunder for their faith.
Right, yeah.
Do you think there could be a connection between these texts?
It's very possible.
Yeah.
The author of Hebrews in chapter 11 lists all these different ways that the faithful suffered.
Right.
And it's very likely that they drew upon this tradition of Isaiah's martyrdom
mm-hmm.
as an example of unwavering faith in the face of persecution.
So we've gone from these deathbed pronouncements
mm-hmm.
to these incredible heavenly ascents
yeah.
and now to the brutal realities of persecution.
It's been quite a journey.
These texts cover so much ground.
They do.
And they really pack an emotional punch.
They really do.
What are some of the key insights we can take away from them so far?
Well, we've only just scratched the surface.
Yeah.
There's so much more to uncover
mm-hmm.
in these fascinating writings.
Totally.
But what stood out to you the most so far?
Oh, man. It's hard to choose.
I know, right?
This deep dive has already been quite the journey.
Yeah, he has.
And I'm super excited to continue exploring these texts with you.
Me too. It's going to be fascinating to see
yeah.
where we go from here.
Yeah. What other oh. secrets and mysteries will we uncover?
Who knows? That's the beauty of it.
I can't wait. So we've been exploring this testament of the 12 patriarchs.
Yes.
Specifically the testament of Levi.
Right.
With that unique focus on Levi's priesthood
uh-huh.
and his crazy journey through those multiple heavens.
Yeah, those are wild.
It really makes you think about
right.
how those ancient authors grappled with these complex figures
yeah.
and their not so perfect pasts.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like they weren't afraid to address
yeah.
those tough questions, you know,
mm-hmm.
about how someone capable of such violence could also be chosen for this sacred role.
It makes you wonder if they saw that
yeah.
as a reflection of, like, the human condition.
Yeah, the potential for darkness and light
right.
within each of us.
It definitely adds a layer of complexity and depth to the text.
For sure.
And speaking of complexity,
okay.
we've also been unpacking martyrdom literature,
okay.
specifically the martyrdom of Isaiah.
Yeah.
That story really stayed with me.
Yeah.
It's hard to shake that image
yeah.
of Isaiah being sawn in half.
It's a brutal image.
Yeah.
And a powerful reminder
mm-hmm.
of the sacrifices people made for their faith.
Thinking back to the Testament of Levi,
okay.
I'm still curious about that prophecy
mm-hmm.
of the three offices. You
right.
mentioned one being greater than any other.
Right.
The second being the priesthood and mm-hmm. the third being shrouded in mystery.
Yeah.
Associated with a king in Judah.
Right.
What's the significance of this threefold division?
Right.
And why do you think the author chose to include it?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
One that has puzzled scholars for centuries.
Really?
Yeah. Some see it as foreshadowing the Messiah, a figure who combines priestly and kingly roles.
Okay. Interesting.
Others interpret it as a reflection of the various leadership roles within the Jewish community at the time.
So it's open to interpretation.
It seems that way.
It's almost like the text is inviting us to engage with these ideas and come up with our own understanding.
Right. Like, what do you think?
Yeah.
What do you think the author was trying to convey?
It's a good question.
Right.
Maybe they wanted to spark discussion.
Yeah.
Encourage readers to think about the complexities of leadership.
Right. And the nature of power.
Maybe they even wanted to plant a seed of hope.
Could be.
Hinting at a future.
Yeah.
Where these different roles would be unified in a harmonious way.
It's a really interesting idea, isn't
it? Yeah. It's like a puzzle that they're leaving us to solve.
A challenge to think deeply about these ideas.
There's another aspect of the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs that I wanted to touch on.
Right.
It's portrayal of women.
Oh, right.
We briefly mentioned that passage from the Testament of Reuben, where women are depicted as deceitful and alluring.
Right.
What do you make of that?
Well, that passage is definitely a reflection of the cultural anxieties about female power and sexuality that were prevalent in the ancient world.
It's a good reminder
to
approach these texts with a critical eye and to consider the historical and cultural factors that might have shaped the author's perspective.
Absolutely. It's all about understanding the historical context and how ideas evolve over time.
It's important to recognize that while these texts offer valuable insights into the past, they also contain elements that we might find problematic or even offensive from our modern perspective.
It's a tough balance.
It is.
We want to engage with these texts authentically, but also acknowledge the ways they might reflect outdated or harmful beliefs.
But beyond those challenging aspects, there's also a strong emphasis on ethical behavior, would you say?
Oh, definitely. The patriarchs, despite their flaws, are presented as models of piety and righteousness. They urge their descendants to live lives of virtue and devotion to God.
So it's not all doom and gloom.
No.
And misogyny.
There's a message of hope and morality in there, too.
Woven into these texts.
Exactly.
These texts give us this glimpse into the minds of people who were wrestling with these huge questions about faith, morality, and the nature of the universe.
You're searching for meaning and purpose, just like we are today.
It's like we're time travelers.
Sounds like, I don't know.
Peering into this world that's both familiar and utterly foreign.
Yeah. It's fascinating.
What's amazing is that despite those vast differences in time and culture, we still connect with their struggles and their aspirations.
It's like a shared human experience.
That's beautifully said.
It really is a testament to the enduring power of these ancient texts.
They're not just relics of the past.
Right.
They're living documents that speak to the human condition.
Across time and space.
They remind us that we're part of a larger story. Mm-hmm. A story that's been unfolding for millennia.
Exactly.
It's like we're holding a torch, carrying this flame of knowledge and inquiry forward.
I like that.
We've inherited this legacy of wisdom and wonder from those who came before us.
And it's our turn now
to
explore these ideas and share them with others.
As we delve deeper into these texts, I'm sure we'll encounter even more thought-provoking ideas, challenging perspectives, and maybe even a few more glimpses into heaven itself.
I'm ready for the next leg of our journey.
I am too. What other treasures await us in these ancient writings? You know, I've been thinking about that question you asked earlier about writing our own testaments.
Oh, right, right.
If we were to pass on wisdom to future generations, what stories would we tell?
Oh, that's a tough one.
What would we want them to know about our time?
Yeah, it's a really profound question to consider.
Yeah.
Like, what truths have we learned?
Yeah.
And how could we frame them in a way that resonates with those who come after us?
The ancient authors we've been talking about, they weren't afraid to tackle those hard parts of their society.
Right. They didn't shy away from anything.
Violence, betrayal, even misogyny.
Yeah, they held up a mirror to their world, warts and all.
It makes you wonder what future generations will make of our cultural narratives.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Imagine them looking back at our social media posts, our movies, our political debates, trying to decipher what it all meant.
It's like we're leaving behind a digital testament of sorts.
And that brings up the question of legacy.
Yeah.
What kind of legacy are we creating?
Right. Are we leaving the world?
Individually and collectively?
Yeah.
How will our choices shape the world?
For the generations that come after us?
It's a big responsibility.
It is.
But it's also an incredible opportunity.
Yeah. We have the power to shape the future.
Mm-hmm.
Not just through our actions.
Right.
But also through the stories we tell.
Mm-hmm.
And the values we pass on.
Speaking of shaping the future, there's one final aspect of these texts that I think deserves a closer look. They're apocalyptic elements.
Right. Those visions of judgment, heavenly realms.
Yeah.
A coming Messiah.
They all point to this deep longing for transformation, a hope for a better world.
It's like acknowledging the imperfections of this world, but still holding on to this belief.
Right.
That something better is possible.
A glimmer of hope amidst the chaos.
Exactly.
And it makes you wonder, what role does hope play in our own lives?
Yeah. How do we deal with all the challenges and uncertainties while still holding on to a vision of a brighter future?
These are timeless questions, aren't they?
They really are.
And that's what makes these ancient texts so compelling.
Yeah, they offer no easy answers.
Right.
But they invite us to wrestle with these big questions.
To engage in a dialogue that spans centuries.
It's pretty amazing.
They offer us a window into the minds and hearts of people who were just like us.
Searching for meaning in a world full of both beauty and suffering.
And in their struggles and hopes, we see echoes of our own human experience.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into testamentary and martyrdom literature, I'm left with a sense of awe at the enduring power of these ancient voices.
They speak across time and space, reminding us of our shared humanity.
And inspiring us to live lives worthy of the stories we inherit.
And for those listening, if you're intrigued by what you've heard today, I encourage you to explore these texts.
Yeah.
Let their stories spark your imagination.
Challenge your assumptions and ignite your own quest for meaning and understanding.
The journey of discovery awaits.